You open your Bible, 2 Samuel, the 11th chapter. Really enjoyed Scott's presentation. I've heard some of that before, but not all of it. That was great. Last night, we spent some time looking at some of the things that we see in the Old Testament, stories that, when you look at them, they are pointing to Jesus. And the details that are told in them, the wording of the story is told in such a way that it's looking forward to Jesus. We want to spend a little time looking at the life of David today, and looking at David as a foreshadowing of Christ. And we're going to especially talk about David's sin with Bathsheba and the aftermath. We'll just mention briefly. You remember how he committed adultery with Bathsheba. And he tried to cover it up. First of all, he had her husband Uriah come home and assumed that he would go home, he'd sleep with his wife, and then later on nobody would know that the child that was born was not Uriah's. Uriah didn't do that. So then he gets Uriah drunk, thinking Uriah will go home to his wife. Uriah didn't do that. So David then sends a letter and says to Joab, the commander of the army, where Uriah was fighting, he says, put Uriah in the hottest part of the Bible and withdraw from him. When you withdraw from him, he'll be killed, and somehow David thinks that his problem will be solved. How did that letter get to the commander of the army? Uriah himself is the one who is charged with carrying it. And then the messenger comes and tells David how that Uriah has been killed. And David acts all cool about it, and saying, in effect, you know, we're going to lose people in battle. Just be stronger and keep fighting. Don't let this bother you too much, which is really cold when you think about it. And then Nathan the prophet comes to David. David's been keeping silent about this, and Nathan tells him the story about the man who had many, many flocks, and the man who had this one poor little ewe lamb, that he treated as his daughter. And the man who had many flocks has a guest come, and he wants to feed his guest, but he didn't want to take one of his many, many, many sheep, so he takes the poor man's ewe lamb and kills it, serves it to his guest. And David is angry. The man ought to die. He's going to have to repay four times what he's taken. And Nathan says, you're the man. Everybody remember that story, right? David could have had, no doubt, any woman in Israel who wasn't married would have been glad to be the wife of the king, even though David already had several wives. And what does he do? He goes and takes Uriah's wife. He's the man. Well, when Nathan confronts him in 2 Samuel, the 12th chapter, let me get there, and tells him this, he says to him in verse 10, now therefore the sword shall never depart from your house, because you have despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. He says, the sword shall never depart from your house. And as you go through the rest of David's life, the rest of his life is a tragedy. In the following verses of this chapter, the child conceived by Bathsheba is going to die. In the next chapter, one of David's sons is going to rape David's daughter. Amnon is going to rape Tamar. And then another one of David's sons, Absalom, is going to kill Amnon, the son who raped Tamar. And then Absalom is going to take the throne from David and try to kill David. And then later on, another son, Adonijah, is going to try to take the throne from David. The sword shall never depart from your house, is what David was told here in 2 Samuel, the 12th chapter. Verse 11 says, thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up evil against you from your own household. I will even take your wives before your eyes and give them to your companion. He shall lie with your wives in broad daylight. I want you to remember that the prophet of God told David that his wives are going to be taken by his companion. Indeed, you did it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel and under the sun. Now what we're going to do is we're going to look at the story of what happens here. And then we're going to look at some things that David says in the Psalms. And you're going to see those things connected with the story that happens here. But then you're going to see, wait a minute, these events and how they are told and some of the language that David uses in describing these things in the psalm really fit Jesus better than they do David, just like we were talking about before. So let's go take a look at what happens here. And I'm going to skip past all of that. We've got to get to the story in 2 Samuel, the 15th chapter now is where we want to go. You know what, we'll get to that in a moment. 2 Samuel, the 15th chapter. Actually, let's go back to chapter 14 and verse 25. Now, in all Israel was no one as handsome as Absalom, so highly praised from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no defect in him. This Absalom, he's a pretty fine-looking man. As a matter of fact, in verse 26, when he cut the hair of his head, it was at the end of every year that he cut it, for it was heavy on him, so he cut it. He weighed the hair of his head at 200 shekels by the king's weight. Does it sound like he's kind of proud of his hair? Absalom is going to turn out to be a guy who's a little bit narcissistic. He's the guy who killed Amnon. He had to leave, and now he's come back. When he comes back in chapter 15, verse 1, it came about after this, chapter 15, verse 1, that Absalom provided for himself a chariot and horses and 50 men as runners before him. What kind of guy has to have 50 runners before him? Probably the kind of guy who grows his hair out every year and he cuts it to see how much it was and who's highly praised by everybody. Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way to the gate. And it happened that when any man had a suit to come to the king for judgment, Absalom would call him and say, "From what city are you?" And he would say, "Your servant is from one of the tribes of Israel." No doubt saying, I'm from the tribe of Judah, or I'm from the tribe of Asher, or I'm from whatever. Then Absalom would say to him, "See, your claims are good and right, but no man listens to you on the part of the king." Who's the king? His own father. What's he doing here? Verse 4, "Moreover, Absalom would say, 'Oh, that one would appoint me judge in the land. Then every man who has any suit or cause could come to me, and I would give him justice.'" What does that sound like? Politician, sure. Guy who wants to be in office, running down the guy who's in office and telling how much better it would be if I were in office, only it's his own father that he's running down. And it happened when a man came near to prostrate himself before him, he would put out his hand and take hold of him and kiss him. Oh, we don't want to go there. And in this manner, Absalom dealt with all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole away the hearts of the men of Israel. It came about at the end of 40 years that Absalom said to the king, "Please let me go and pay my vow which I vowed to the Lord of Hebron. For you, sir, vowed a vow while I was living at Geshur in Syria, saying, 'If the Lord shall indeed bring me back to Jerusalem, then I'll serve the Lord.' The king said to him, 'Go in peace.' So he rose and went to Hebron." What does he say he's going to Hebron for? To pay a vow. What's he really going to Hebron for? Absalom sent spies. This is verse 10. Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, "As soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then you shall say, 'Absalom is king in Hebron.'" Then 200 men went with Absalom from Jerusalem who were invited and went innocently, and they did not know anything. And Absalom sent for Ahithophel the Gilonite. Ahithophel the Gilonite. You want to say Ahithophel the Gilonite. James, say Ahithophel the Gilonite. We need to remember him. He was David's counselor. He was from his city Gilo, which is why he's called the Gilonite, while he was offering the sacrifices. And the conspiracy was strong, for the people increased continually with Absalom. We need to find out something about this Ahithophel. Turn over to chapter 16, last verse in the chapter. Chapter 16, verse 23. "The advice of Ahithophel, which he gave in those days, was as if one inquired of the word of God. So was all the advice of Ahithophel regarded by both David and Absalom." How did David regard the word of Ahithophel? As if it were the word of God. Would you say David trusted Ahithophel? It's kind of interesting. How would a man whom David trusted so much, why would he turn against David? So Ahithophel is going to go over and he's going to be on Absalom's side. In 2 Samuel chapter 23, there's a list of David's inner cadre, his 30 mighty men. Among them is a man named Eliam in chapter 23, verse 34. He is said to be the son of Ahithophel the Gilonite. So Ahithophel has a son who is one of David's inner cadre. And then in chapter 23, verse 39, we find Uriah the Hittite was one of these 30 mighty men. So Uriah is not just any soldier. He's one of these 30, along with Eliam, the son of Ahithophel. Guess what? Uriah's wife, Bathsheba, is said to be the daughter of Eliam, back in 2 Samuel chapter 11.
So, you've got Uriah and Eliam. Ahithophel is the father of Eliam. Bathsheba is the daughter of Eliam. Uriah marries the granddaughter of Ahithophel. And so when David defiles Bathsheba, he is defiling the granddaughter of Ahithophel. And when he has Uriah murdered, he is having murdered the husband of Ahithophel's granddaughter. Can you suppose that perhaps when there's this opportunity to see somebody taking the kingdom away from David, Ahithophel might have had motivation to say, you know what, I'll go with that. Be that as it may, we want to get the story here. We're going to read about a guy named Hushai who also goes over to Absalom's side, but as a spy. Let's get to that. We come down into 2 Samuel, the 17th chapter. I'm sorry, 2 Samuel, the 15th chapter, verse 13. 2 Samuel 15, verse 13. A messenger came to David saying, "The hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom." And David said to all his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, "Arise, let us flee. Otherwise none of us shall escape from Absalom. Go in haste, lest he overtake us quickly and bring down calamity on us and strike the city with the sword, with the edge of the sword." And the king's servants said to the king, "Behold, your servants are ready to do whatever my lord the king chooses." So the king went out, and all his household with him. But the king left 10 concubines to keep the house. What did he leave? He left 10 concubines. These are wives. Wives of a slave class, but they're wives. And he leaves them there to keep the house. And the king went out, and all the people with him. They stopped at the last house, and all the servants passed on beside him. And it mentions various ones. And in the next few verses, there are people who come out to David, and they say, "David, I want to go with you." And some of them, David will talk out of it. He'll say, "No, you know what? I've got enough people with me." How many people with him? Look at verse 18. 600 men who had come with him from Gath. Gath was in the region of the Philistines. Remember in 1 Samuel when David had been fleeing from Saul? He'd gone out into the wilderness, and first of all, there were about 400 men that had come out with him, and then there were a total of about 600 men. Do you remember what David and those 600 men were doing? They were out there, they were protecting Nabal's flocks for a while, but they were also fighting various cities and destroying them. In other words, this is a fighting force. This is an army that David has formed out here in the wilderness, 600 men. Now David's leaving the city with these 600 men. Somebody else comes out and says, "Can I go with you?" David says, no, you just stay. And somebody else comes out. Verse 24, Zadok, priest, came. All the Levites with him, carrying the Ark of the Covenant of God. And they set down the Ark of God. And Abiathar came up until all the people had finished passing from the city. And the king said to Zadok, "Return the Ark of God to the city. If I find favor in the sight of the Lord, then he'll bring me back again and show me both it and his habitation. But if he should say thus, I have no delight in you. Behold, here I am. Let him do to me as seems good to him." What do you see in David's attitude right there? You know what? If God ends up being happy with me, he's going to take me back. I don't need to haul this ark around. And on the other hand, if God's not happy with me, I'm hauling the ark around as long as he could. And then he says in verse 27, the king said to Zadok the priest, "Are you not a seer, a prophet? Return to the city in peace, and your two sons with you, your son Ahimaaz and Jonathan, the son of Abiathar. See, I'm going to wait at the fords of the wilderness, the places where you would cross the streams, where you'd have shallow places you could cross. I'm going to wait there until word comes from you to inform me." And so the idea is, the priests have these two sons. They can stay in the city. They can watch what's going on in Jerusalem. They can see what Absalom's up to. They can send word by their sons, Jonathan and Ahimaaz, and get it out to David. Tell him what's going on. Verse 30. David went up the ascent of the Mount of Olives. So if you can picture, last night we said east was that direction. I'm sure it's not really, but we're pretending it is. So let's do that again. You've got Jerusalem here, and you have the Temple Mount in Jesus' time. So Solomon builds the temple here. And if you come down from the east wall of the temple, you immediately drop down into the Kidron Valley like this, heading east. And then you cross the Kidron River, the Kidron stream there, and you start up. And what is it you're starting up? The Mount of Olives. You're starting up the western slope of the Mount of Olives. And what is there that's right here on the western slope of the Mount of Olives? The Garden of Gethsemane. And you would come on up and top the Mount of Olives and head on over to Bethany where Lazarus and Mary and Martha lived. David went up the ascent of the Mount of Olives. He's fleeing Jerusalem. Starts up the Mount of Olives.
wept as he went. What does that remind you of? Well, there's going to be more that's going to remind you of Jesus as we go along. His head was covered and he walked barefoot. Then all the people who were with him each covered his head and went up weeping as they went. Now someone told David, saying, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. And David said, O Lord, I pray, make the counsel of Ahithophel foolishness. It happened as David was coming to the summit where God was worshipped that, behold, Hushai, the Archite, met him with his coat torn and dust on his head. And David said to him, if you pass over with me, you'll be a burden to me. One more mouth to feed, one more guy I have to take care of. But if you return to the city and say to Absalom, I'll be your servant, O king, as I've been your father's servant in time past, so I will now be your servant, then you can thwart the counsel of Ahithophel for me. And he tells them about Zadok and Abiathar the priest and the sons of the priest. And so now, Hushai, you can go in there, watch what Absalom's doing, tell the priest, priest tell the sons, sons come and tell me. So what does he want Hushai to do? He wants Hushai to be a spy, a double agent over there. Well, let's come down to chapter 16, verse 5. When David came to Bahurim, and it's just a few miles, I think if I remember right, maybe just a couple miles north by northeast of Jerusalem, so David hasn't gotten far. When David came to Bahurim, behold, there came out from there a man of the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera. He came out cursing continually as he came. He threw stones at David and all the servants of King David, all the people and all the mighty men were at his right hand and at his left. Here's a king with 600 soldiers. And here's a guy who's going to come out and throw rocks at him and curse him and kick dust at him. And David puts up with it. Thus Shimei said in verse 7 when he cursed, get out, you man of bloodshed and worthless fellow. The Lord has returned upon you all the bloodshed of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. And the Lord has given the kingdom into the hand of your son Absalom. Behold, you are taken in your own evil, for you are a man of bloodshed. What tribe was Shimei from? Benjamin, from the house of Saul. He's a relative of Saul. He's naturally upset from way back that Saul's kingship ended so poorly and now David is king and he blames David. Is it fair to blame David for Saul's demise? Did David kill Saul? Was he guilty of Saul's blood? He had opportunity to kill Saul and he didn't do it. Remember, cut the hem of his garment off and felt bad about that? When Saul died, David mourned him profoundly. Anybody ever accuse you of something you didn't do? How do you feel about it when somebody accuses you of something you didn't do? Now watch this though. Take the word Saul out of the accusation. Shimei said when he cursed, get out, you man of bloodshed. Was David a man of bloodshed? Worthless fellow, the Lord has returned upon you all the bloodshed. Is what is happening right now because of David's bloodshed? And then he comes down and he says, behold, you are taken in your own evil, for you are a man of bloodshed. Was that a fair statement? What I'm saying to you is, In what Shimei says, there are some things that are accurate. But Shimei goes too far and he accuses David of being guilty of Saul's bloodshed, which was not true. There's a lesson for us here. What happens when you've done something wrong, when I've done something I know I shouldn't have done, and somebody comes at me and they start laying into me, but they kind of go a little bit beyond and they accuse me of some things that I didn't do. I ignore all of the truth in what they're saying, and I just get all indignant. How dare you? But I certainly didn't do that. How dare you accuse me of such and such? And I don't even listen to the part that I need to be listening to. Listen to David's response. In verse 9, he has a nephew named Abishai. He had three nephews, Joab, Asahel, and Abishai, that were all sons of his sister Zeruiah. And Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said to the king, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over now and cut off his head. Sons of Zeruiah, especially Abishai, were always wanting to cut off somebody's head. And the king said, what have I to do with you, O sons of Zeruiah? If he curses, and if the Lord has told him, curse David, then who shall say, why have you done so? Why would David think maybe the Lord has told him to curse David?
What's David thinking about? The sword will not depart from your house because of what you've done, David. You're going to suffer. And then it goes on and it says, David said to Abishai, to all his servants, behold, my son, who came out from me, talking about Absalom, seeks my life. How much more now this Benjamite? If my own son is seeking my life, I can kind of understand why this Benjamite might. Let him alone, let him curse, for the Lord has told him. David ignores the unfairness in what Shimei says. And he just says, you know what? I've got this coming. Verse 12, perhaps the Lord will look on my affliction and will return good to me instead of his cursing this day. So David and his men went on the way, and you just picture this. Shimei went along on the hillside parallel with him. Here's David and all the mighty men. Here's Shimei. And he went and he cursed and he cast stones and threw dust at him. Now, we'll come down to verse 15. We're going to find out what's happening in Jerusalem. Absalom and all the people, the men of Israel, entered Jerusalem, and Ahithophel with him. And it came about when Hushai the Archite, David's friend, that's the spy, came to Absalom, that Hushai said to Absalom, long live the king, long live the king. And Absalom said to Hushai, is this your loyalty to your friend? Why did you not go with your friend? And Hushai said to Absalom, no, for whom the Lord, this people, and all the men of Israel have chosen, his will I be, and with him I'll remain. Besides, whom should I serve? Should I not serve in the presence of his son? As I've served in your father's presence, so I will be in your presence. Okay, so now we know two counselors that Absalom now has. Ahithophel and Hushai, who's really a spy, a double agent. So, verse 20. Absalom said to Ahithophel, give your advice, what should we do? And Ahithophel said to Absalom, go into your father's concubines, whom he's left to keep the house. Do you remember? David left 10 concubines. Do you remember what Nathan the prophet said to David? He said, you did this secretly, but your companion is going to take your wives and is going to do it in the sight of all Israel. Watch the text. Go into your father's concubines, whom he has left to keep the house. Then all Israel will hear that you've made yourself odious to your father. The hands of all who are with you will also be strengthened. So they pitched a tent for Absalom on the roof, and Absalom went into his father's concubines in the sight of all Israel. They set up a tent right up there on the palace. And Ahithophel goes into his father's wives. What's going on here? He says, you'll make yourself odious to your father in the sight of all Israel. You can imagine David has been a hero. It's not so much that people hate David, but they really like this new guy, Absalom. But, you know, you could see people being a little bit like foot in each camp. Well, you know, I don't want anything bad to happen to David, but I really like Absalom. But if they see Absalom acting in such a way that they see there's going to be no peace between David and Absalom, you've got to make a choice. You're on one side or the other. And you can also think about the fact that, in a sense, Absalom is sending a message. What was my father's is now mine. His wives, they're mine. His palace, it's mine. The kingdom, it's mine. It's all mine. Then it makes the statement about how much David and now Absalom trusted Ahithophel. Chapter 17, Ahithophel has some more advice. Ahithophel said to Absalom, please let me choose 12,000 men that I may arise and pursue David tonight. I will come upon him while he is weary and exhausted and will terrify him so that all the people who are with him will flee. I'll strike down the king. Next word is important. Alone. I will bring back all the people to you. The return of everyone depends on the man you seek. Then all the people shall be at peace. We don't need to defeat the army. All we need to do is kill David. That's what this all hinges upon, just that one man. Kill David, and then all the people will be yours. And he says, I'll take 12,000 people, and I'll do it tonight. So the plan pleased Absalom and all the elders of Israel. Does that sound like a good plan? If you are thinking in terms of Absalom succeeding, getting the kingdom, does that sound like what he should do? David's on the run. He's barely had a chance to catch his breath. He's barefoot, and he's on the run. You take 12,000 men, you get him now. You know, you don't get in the fourth quarter, and you're ahead by a touchdown and start playing prevent defense. That's not what you do. You go in for the kill. And that's what Absalom should have done if he'd wanted, just not talking from a right or wrong standpoint, just from a military standpoint. But Absalom said in verse 5, "Now call Hushai the Archite also, and let us hear what he has to say." And Hushai had come to when Hushai had come to Absalom, Absalom said to him, "Ahithophel spoken thus. Shall we carry out his plan? If not, you speak." Hushai said to Absalom, "This time, the advice of Ahithophel, the advice that Ahithophel has given, is not good." Why do you say this time? This time, the advice of Ahithophel is not good. Because Ahithophel's advice was always good. Except this time, he's blown it. How are you going to convince Absalom or anybody else that Ahithophel has blown it this time? "Moreover, Hushai said, you know your father and his men, that they are mighty men, and they are fierce like a bear robbed of her cubs in the field. And your father is an expert in warfare." Imagine that you're Absalom, and you've gotten all cocky, and you've taken the throne, and now you're being advised, send a force out to kill David. And all of a sudden you're reminded, your father is an expert in warfare. What had your father done? What was he famous for? He killed Goliath, the giant. What did they sing about David? Saul has slain his thousands, but David his 10,000s. And all those memories start coming back to mind. Oh no, that's right. My father's a great soldier. And then Hushai goes ahead and he says, look, if we go rushing into this thing following Ahithophel's plan, David's cunning. He's not going to be with the main force. He'll be hiding up here in a cave or something. We'll go in and we'll attack the main force. And then here comes David down from the side unexpectedly. And some of our people will get killed and we'll panic and it'll all be a disaster. Oh no, Absalom's home. And then he says, but let's wait and get the whole nation, all the people, all the men of war from the whole nation together. And let's have such a great force that then, Absalom, you can go into battle personally and get personal credit. And then there's a lot of bravado. If David hides in the city, we'll throw ropes about the city and we'll drag it into the valley and we'll get David and all of this kind of thing. And so now he appeals both to Absalom's vanity and his insecurity. And so Absalom decides, okay, this is the better plan. Down in verse 14, Absalom and all the men of Israel said the counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. But then it tells us the Lord was behind this. The Lord had ordained to thwart the good counsel of Ahithophel in order that the Lord might bring calamity on Absalom. So Hushai now gets word to the priests. The priests get word to their sons. The sons go out. Somebody actually sees them. They have to hide in a well. But then they get out. They go tell David. They say, David, you've got some time. David crosses the fords. You know the rest of the story. David does regroup. His forces end up defeating Absalom. And Absalom gets killed, even though David didn't want Absalom to get killed. David gets the kingdom back. But before all that happens, right here, Ahithophel gave the advice that Absalom needed to follow if he were going to defeat David. And Absalom rejects Ahithophel's advice and takes some foolhardy advice from Hushai. I say foolhardy, it was God's plan so that Absalom would fail. But it's not the advice he should have followed if he were going to succeed. Do you think Ahithophel could see, oh no, don't follow Hushai's advice? No, that's going to be disaster. So if you're Ahithophel and you see Absalom rejecting the only advice that was going to bring success and following advice that is going to lead to certain disaster, what are your career options now? Obviously, not going anywhere, you stick with Absalom. You go back to David and say, hey, David, can I have my old job back? Not likely. Chapter 17, verse 23. When Ahithophel saw that his counsel was not followed, he sat on his donkey and arose and went to his home, to his city, set his house in order, and strangled himself. Thus he died and was buried in the grave of his father. All right, so that's the story that we need to have in mind. Psalm 41. David writes this psalm. He says, "For me, I said, O Lord, be gracious to me, heal me, for I have sinned against you." Can you think about this psalm, what period of time David might have written this psalm? Well, of course, we're very familiar with the notable sin of David when he committed the adultery with Bathsheba. And obviously, in the story we've just read, David is aware that he's suffering things because he deserves them, because of what he's done wrong. Can you imagine David writing Psalm 41 in the aftermath of his sin against Bathsheba? And he says, my enemies, in 2 Psalm 16, verse 11, remember when Shimei was cursing him, And David said, let him alone and let him curse, for the Lord has told him to. Why would David say something like that? Because he remembers what Nathan the prophet said to him, and he's aware of his sin. And then David says in the psalm, my enemy saved me in malice. When will he die and his name perish? Remember what Ahithophel's advice was. All we have to do is kill David. Just take down that man alone, and then all the people will be yours. We just need his name to perish so that there's not still a possibility of people saying, well, what about David? Maybe we should be loyal to David. I will strike down the king alone and bring back all the people to you. And then the psalm goes on and says, when one comes to see me, he utters empty words. The New American Standard says, speaks falsehood while his heart gathers iniquity. When he goes out, he tells abroad. What would David maybe have been thinking about saying? Somebody comes to see me and he speaks false word, he goes out. Well, in 2 Samuel 15, David was saying, or Absalom was saying to the people, your claims are good and right. There's no man designated by the king to hear you. Oh, that I were judging the land, and so on. But I think more likely what this refers to is when Absalom says to David, let me go to Hebron and pay a vow. And actually, when he went to Hebron, he had it announced, I'm king. Doesn't that sound like he speaks falsehood to me? And then he goes out and tells it abroad. Psalm 41, coming down the passage. All who hate me whisper together about me. They imagine the worst for me. They say a deadly thing is poured out on him. He will not arise again from where he lies. And I can imagine that. If you're a citizen of Judah or even Israel at this time, and you're aware David has fled the capital, he's out there in the wilderness, And Ahithophel's down Absalom's side, and Absalom's got all these forces, and they're going to kill that. I bet when the sun comes up in the morning, David won't even be alive. Even my close friend, in whom I trusted, who ate my bread, has lifted his heel against me. Who did David trust that lifted his heel against David? Ahithophel. And as a counselor to David, he would have sat at David's table and would have eaten David's bread. But you may recognize this statement from another passage, and that's in John 13 when it's quoted by Jesus referring to Judas, even my close friend in whom I trusted, who ate my bread has lifted his heel against me. Judas, who killed himself, like Ahithophel killed himself, as did Ahithophel. David had trusted Ahithophel. Did Jesus trust Judas? Jesus knew from the beginning who would betray him. So it's not that Jesus ever thought, well, I think Judas is a really good guy. But the Bible does take pains to tell us that Jesus entrusted Judas with the bag, the money bag. Judas is the one who had the responsibility of keeping the funds. You might ask yourself, why is it that Judas ended up with that responsibility if the Lord knew he was going to betray Jesus? One of the things that we see when we look at the comparisons between an Old Testament story and the New Testament events, and the things in the Old Testament story that are parallel and foreshadow the coming Jesus, a shadow is not exactly like the thing that it's reflecting, or that it's I don't know how you say that, but it's shadowing. So if you had somebody back here in this room back here, and there was a bright light, and you could see the shadow there, if you saw the shadow, could you tell that it was probably a person? Could you tell what person it was? You could tell it was a person, not a rabbit, say, for example, but you probably couldn't tell what person it was because the shadow doesn't look exactly like the person. So when you see something like this where it talks about David trusted Ahithophel and then Jesus with his 12 apostles and Judas is the one who carries the bag, no, Jesus didn't think of Judas the same way David thought of Ahithophel. But you see something kind of similar there as part of a body of similarities. So with that in mind, we want to look at Psalm 22, which is another psalm that David writes. And we want to think about Psalm 22 like Psalm 41, where we see David describing his own circumstances, and yet he says something that ends up being about Jesus and Jesus being betrayed by Judas. So in Psalm 22, you have this statement, verse 6. I am a worm and not a man, scorned by mankind and despised by people. Can you see anything in the story that we've talked about that would kind of fit David, where David would say, I'm a worm and not a man, despised by the people. And Shimei comes out and is cursing him, and that's really a reflection of the attitudes of a lot of the people. He's being treated as a worm. Well, we compare Psalm 22 and Matthew chapter 27, where Jesus is being crucified. And of course, we have the statement, my God, why have you forsaken me in Psalm 22? And Jesus makes a very similar statement in Matthew 27. But it's interesting to look at the context just before this statement. The things that are being described as happening as Jesus hangs on the cross, and look at other similarities between Matthew 27 and Psalm 22. For example, in Psalm 22, verse 7, it says, all who see me mock me. And while the wording, the vocabulary is a little different, the idea is similar. In Matthew 27, verse 41, the chief priests with the scribes and elders mocked him. And then it says in Psalm 22 and verse 7, they wagged their heads. And in Matthew 27, verse 39, those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads. In verse 8 of Psalm 22, he trusts in the Lord. David characterizes his enemies as saying, he trusts in the Lord. Let him deliver him. Let him rescue him, for he delights in him. And of Jesus, they were saying, he trusts in God. Let God deliver him now, if he desires him. You see those similarities. Of course, there's the statement in Psalm 22, verse 16, they have pierced my hands and my feet. Is there anything in the story that we studied, is there anything about them piercing David's hands and his feet? I guess you might say, well, he went up the Mount of Olives barefoot, so maybe he got his feet pierced. But I think at the very least you could say, figuratively speaking, David is describing the agony that he's going through. But it's interesting that he chooses the words, they pierced his hands and his feet, or they pierced my hands and my feet. And then we look at Jesus, whom David foreshadows, and that's literally exactly what they did to Jesus. And again, we're talking about Old Testament passages where sometimes the language fits Jesus better than the Old Testament situation. Take now your son, your only son, fits Jesus better than it does Isaac. And then there's the statement in Psalm 22, verse 18, they divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. In Matthew chapter 27, where they crucified him, they divided his garments among them by casting lots. John 19 goes into details as to why they did that. It was a garment without a seam in it. There's not a convenient place to rip it without ruining it. So they just cast lots for this garment. And then John says, this was to fulfill the scripture which says, and quote Psalm 22, they divided my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. And so what I want you to notice here is that sometimes when we talk about prophecy, and we're not talking about something where there was a prediction in the Old Testament, we're not talking about something where somebody says, like in Micah 5:2, this is going to happen in the future, but rather we're seeing something describing an Old Testament event, the language that is used is foreshadowing Jesus, and so it can rightly be said, that passage is fulfilled in Jesus. It has a meaning beyond the immediate story. Now, what we've done is we've looked at parallels in the life of David and the life of Jesus. We've not looked at all of them, but we've looked at a few here, particularly in this story when he's betrayed by the fellows, Jesus was betrayed by Judas. And we looked at Psalm 22, where David seems to be describing his own circumstances, and we've seen a number of parallels in phrasing. What I want to do is caution you here and say that parallels in and of themselves do not prove inspiration. So here's some interesting things. Abraham Lincoln was elected to Congress in 1846, and John F. Kennedy was elected to Congress in 1946. Abraham Lincoln was elected president in 1860, and John F. Kennedy was elected president in 1960. The names Lincoln and Kennedy each have seven letters. Both wives lost children while living in the White House, and both presidents were shot on a Friday, and both were shot in the head. Lincoln's second, that's not right, actually. Both were assassinated by Southerners, if you count Maryland as being in the South. Both were succeeded by Southerners. Both successors were named Johnson. Kennedy was succeeded by Lyndon Johnson, and Lincoln was succeeded by Andrew Johnson. Andrew Johnson was born in 1808. Lyndon Johnson was born in 1908. This is just incredible. John Wilkes Booth, and that's a year off, actually. Both names are comprised of 15 letters. Booth ran from the theater and was caught in a warehouse. If you can count a tobacco barn as a warehouse. Oswald ran from a warehouse and was caught in a theater. Both Booth and Oswald were assassinated before their trials. Isn't that amazing, all those parallels? So what are we saying here? We say that somehow Kennedy foreshadowed Lincoln and that was all part of a divine plan or something? Parallels happen in history. The fact is, with the computers that we have these days, and if you put enough information into a database, we can find Mo Akamozo, put a bunch of information in there about Mo and his birth date and his hobbies and where he's lived and whatnot. And we could go back through all the database of history and we could find somebody else, another Mo Akamozo somewhere back in history. Please, let it not be so. Another Mo Akamozo. But that's a little different. When you look at these parallels here, Lincoln and Kennedy, nobody noticed these parallels until after Kennedy was assassinated. It was in the 1960s when Scott and I were kids. Kennedy was assassinated in 63, and then pretty soon you started seeing the ads on the back of the comic books, and I remember them. They would give you just a few of these, and they'd say, send us some money, and we'll send you the whole list of them. When he got shot, like Lincoln was shot, people started going, look at this, looking backwards. You can take anybody, and if you're looking backwards, you'll find somebody back there where there's a lot of parallels. But what if somebody in 1900, 40 years after Lincoln was assassinated, 60 years before, 40 years before Lincoln's elected, or before he takes off, before he's elected, and 60 years before Kennedy is elected, what if in 1900 somebody had said, Lincoln was a great president, and you're going to come forward in our line of presidents, and we're going to have another Lincoln. And then that happens with Kennedy. Now that would have been impressive. And we'd start saying, this guy in 1900, how did he get that information? Was he a prophet? David lives 1,000 years before Christ. 400 years before Christ comes, 600 years before Christ comes, and 400 years after David, Ezekiel talks about the coming Christ, and guess what he calls him? Look at Ezekiel chapter 37, verse 24. In Ezekiel 37, verse 24, the prophet is talking about the coming kingdom, the coming messianic kingdom, and the coming Messiah. In the context where he's saying, I'll put my spirit upon them, they'll no longer be two nations, they'll have one king. And in Ezekiel 37, verse 24, he says, my servant who will be king? He doesn't say Jesus, he says, my servant David will be king over them. Jeremiah does the same thing. What I'm telling you is that in the Old Testament, hundreds of years before Jesus, they were already saying, when they talked about the Messiah, they were using David to represent him. It was already established. David represents somebody who's coming. And then within the same line here, the same family, the same line of kings, you've got a whole book that is about this coming Messiah, this coming king. And you've got this great king in the Old Testament, and they start saying there's going to be another one of him in this one body of literature. And then you have the parallels. Now that's amazing. Now, I want to talk just a little bit about a whole lot of parallels, because what makes this so impressive to me is not just that there are one or two parallels, but that there are very, very many. What I want to emphasize here, last night we looked at Abraham's sacrifice of Isaac. We looked at Jacob's dream, we looked at the Passover, and I can't begin to give you everything that is in the Old Testament that points to Jesus, but I just want to run real quickly in the last 6 minutes here through a whole bunch of things. Melchizedek, of course, in the Old Testament, he is both a king and a priest, as Jesus is going to be king and priest. There's a lot of things in that story. Why is Melchizedek even mentioned in that story? It's a story about a war between four kings and five kings, and Melchizedek is not among them. But he is king of Salem, which means king of peace, and his name means king of righteousness. And in the book of Hebrews, there are a lot of parallels drawn between them. He is without father, without mother, in the story, he just pops into existence. No, nothing about his birth, nothing about his death. Thus, he's parallel to the Son of God. There is the sacrifice of Isaac that we talked about last night, Jacob's dream that we talked about last night, Passover that we talked about last night. In Exodus, the fourth Exodus the 16th chapter, God gives the people manna, and he does so for 40 years. And at the end of the 40 years, in Deuteronomy, the 8th chapter, it talks about the fact that God led them into the wilderness for 40 years and let them be hungry and tested them and fed them with manna. And then you come, and then it says that God was teaching them a lesson. Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. And then you come to Deuteronomy, or Matthew, the fourth chapter, and you have Jesus led by the Spirit of God into the wilderness, 40 days, to be tested. Tempted means tested. And he was hungry, and then he quotes that passage, Deuteronomy, the eighth chapter. The tabernacle we talked about last night. David we talked about today. David being betrayed. We haven't talked everything about David. Various parallels between David and Jesus. Solomon, in 2 Samuel, the 7th chapter, David is told Solomon is going to build a house. Says his son is going to build a house. Well, Solomon is that son, according to 2 Chronicles chapter 22. According to Hebrews chapter 1, is Jesus. And there's various language, various phrases there when God tells David his son is going to build a house. My loving kindness will not depart from him like it did from Saul. And when he commits iniquity, I will afflict him with the rod of men and the strokes of the hands of men. If I've got that, I may have missed one word there. And then you think about Jesus. He didn't commit iniquity, but he became iniquity. He was made to be sin on our behalf. And he was afflicted. They struck him. They scourged him. Now Solomon, in Solomon's case, that affliction takes the form of God raising up adversaries against David in 1 Kings, the 11th chapter. But nobody literally strikes him or hits him with their hand. There the language fits Jesus better than it does Solomon. But the language is about both. There's Elijah in the Old Testament who foreshadows John the Baptist. And Elisha then, whose name is very similar in meaning to the name of Jesus, who does a number of miracles. He feeds a whole bunch of people and they take up leftovers when they had very, very little to begin with, like the feeding of the 5,000. He raises a woman's son from the dead in Nain, actually in Shunem, about 1 or 2 kilometers from Nain, where Jesus raises a woman's son from the dead. There is the fact that he makes an axe head float on the water, like Jesus walks on the water. And then there is the fact that in his death he gives life to others. When he is dead and buried, they throw somebody into his tomb, and that somebody comes to life. And you remember when Jesus was crucified and he's raised from the dead, people coming to life. And so you see a number of parallels between Elisha and Jesus. The flood story. Peter makes the connection between the flood story and talks about we are saved by water, the like figure whereunto water doth also now save us. He says in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 20, he says, 8 souls were saved by water. They weren't saved from the water, they were saved by the water. It was a wicked, sinful world, and they were separated from that wicked, sinful world when they came through the water. And Peter compares that to baptism. And then there is Joseph. And real quickly here, I just want to call your attention to some interesting parallels between Joseph and Jesus. And I do have this one ready if I can just find it. There it is. Joseph, type of Christ. Remember, Judas is one of 12 apostles who sells Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. Who sold Joseph? One of 12. It was Judah, his brother. Judah, in Genesis 27th chapter, says to his brothers, what profit is it to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Let's sell him. They sell him for 20 pieces of silver. Do you know that Judah and Judas are exactly the same name? It's only in our English translations that they come out as different names. So you've got one of 12 selling somebody. And then there is the fact that he who was dead appeared to 10 and then to 11. Jesus, after he's raised from the dead, appears to the apostles, but Thomas is not there. And a week later, and of course that would be 10, because Judas has killed himself. And then a week later, Jesus appears to 11. Thomas is with them. Well, Joseph in the Old Testament twice is said to be dead by his brothers. They thought he was dead. And then they come down to Egypt, and Benjamin is not with them, and so there's 10 of them.
And then they go back and they get Benjamin, bring him down, and then Joseph appears to 11.
And then you start looking at a lot of parallels in the story. Mocked by unbelievers in both cases, sent by the father, hated by those whom he sent, seeking his brothers, falsely accused, a servant exalted. In Genesis 41, Pharaoh said to Joseph, "See, I've set you over all the land of Egypt." Got what, 1 minute, Nathan? "Sent over all the land of Egypt, and Pharaoh took off his signet ring from his hand, put it on Joseph's hand, clothed him in garments of fine linen, put the gold necklace around his neck. He had him ride in his second chariot. They proclaimed, 'Bow the knee.'" So here, what was the day before this? What was Joseph? He was a prisoner. And before that, what was he? He was a slave. Well, here's Jesus taking the form of a servant. He humbled himself, becoming obedient. Wherefore also God highly exalted him, gave unto him the knee, which is above every name, that in the name of Jesus every knee should bow. Joseph is said to be equal to Pharaoh. Jesus was accused of making himself equal with God. So he was second to Pharaoh, and he was equal with Pharaoh. Jesus is subordinate to the Father, and yet equal. And there are a number of other parallels we could talk about between Joseph and Jesus. But let me real quick go back to the other slideshow and just finish out some of these real quickly. Coming out of Egypt, they were slaves in Egypt, the Israelites were. They came through the Red Sea and they were free. In Exodus chapter 14, verse 30, it says, "Thus the Lord saved Israel that day." That's when they were saved from their bondage. Of course, in 1 Corinthians 10, Paul compares that to baptism. We are slaves to sin. We come through the water and we are free. And then there's the bronze serpent, where they were being bitten by serpents that were bringing death, and they looked to a serpent on a standard that was the likeness of the thing that was biting them, and they could be saved from death. We are being bitten by sin, and that brings about death, and we can look to our sin on the cross in Jesus, and we are saved. And you look at all those stories and you just say, wow, and then you start to realize we're not being given an account of just random stories because they happened. These are things God caused to happen in the way that He caused them to happen so that they would point to the Christ, and then He has them described in writing using language that fits Jesus better often than it fits the Old Testament story. There's Joshua who leads them into the promised land, and Joshua is exactly the same name as Jesus who leads us into our promised land. And then there's another Joshua later on who foreshadows Jesus. Alright, so what I'm trying to leave you with is this. Last night we looked at four things, I think. Today we looked at something in the life of David. What I want you to see is, it's not just a kind of a cherry-picking, let me find something that could parallel Jesus. It's a collection of writings that begins with a problem of sin and death, ends with a solution, Jesus. And all along the way, story after story after story after story, is hinting at what's coming. If it were a novel written by one person, I could understand how that happens. If it's a book written by 40 people over 1,500 years, how in the world did the people who wrote the first part know what to point forward to? How did they know what stories to tell and how to tell them? Unless they were being directed by somebody who's writing one book and he knows where it's all going. I thank you very much.